going to kick it right off tonight with homeless headlines. Homeless teens can benefit from Kids Unlimited. Homeless teens in Medford can soon plug into social services and after-school programs in a single stop. Integration is the focus of the new Kids Unlimited Youth Service Center, which also aims to improve teens' overall mental health, said Mary Solomon, homeless education liaison with the Student Service Specialist for the Medford School District. Giving homeless teens an access point for all their basic needs, the center incorporates showers, a dining facility, clothing bank, and a referral service for medical and counseling concerns. Taking the stigma out of free service is another of Kids Unlimited goals, in addition to involving at-risk kids in positive activities. Quote, "The fact that these kids don't eat is one concern," Cole said. The Medford District estimates that it has about 1,200 homeless students. Because many of them are low income, they will be eligible for free meals at this drop-in center.
The Coalition on Human Needs wants you to know and be concerned about the repeal of the estate tax, which may happen next week in the Congress. They want you to know three vital facts about the estate tax. First, repealing or drastically cutting it would cost $1 trillion over 10 years. And if the tax rate is dropped as proposed, more than half the benefits will go to 700 estates worth more than $20 million each. They each get $9 million in tax handouts in 2011 alone. There are also three vital facts about America they want you to know. The gap between the rich and everyone else is growing. The wealthiest 1% own more than the bottom 90%, and it's been getting worse over the past 15 years, according to the Federal Reserve Board. The U.S. faces major new cuts for retirement and health care over the next decades. Over the next 25 years, Medicare will grow from 8 to 14% as a share of the economy. Not a good time to lose trillions in revenue.
California approved $75 million allocation to permanent supportive housing. California Governor Arnold Schwarzenegger approved a proposal to designate $75 million per year of Mental Health Services Act funding over the next 20 years to the creation of supportive housing for people with mental illness. Kim Belshi, Secretary of Health and Human Services, and Daryl Steinberg jointly announced the new initiative on May 11th. California supportive housing staff will undertake activities to ensure this new funding tool works for the organizations that create housing and, most importantly, for people who live there. In Multnomah County, where we have a 10-year plan to end homelessness, we are also looking for this type of funding alignment that would commit mental health dollars to help provide for housing stability once someone who's been living on the streets gets into a housing unit.
This weekly Medicare consumer advocacy update. This week, the House Energy and Commerce Committee, one of the House committees with oversight over Medicare, held its first hearing on the government's implementation of Medicare's Part D drug benefit, so-called. Representatives heard testimony from Part D drug plans. They heard from pharmacists, and they heard from the administration's Centers for Medicare and Medicaid Services. But they did not hear from a single person who was a beneficiary of Medicare. If they had, they would have heard a different, truer story, perhaps one the congressional leadership would prefer to ignore. That the number of rejected prescription claims grew by 24% between January and March of this year, a time period coinciding with the introduction of the Medicare Part D prescription drug benefit. The top reason why people were not dispensed medicines under Medicare during this time was because the prescriptions were not covered by the Part D plan. According to Congressman John Dingell, ranking Democrat on the committee, quote, "I am disappointed that the Republican majority refused to allow the committee to hear from any witness who would give a beneficiary perspective on pharmacy issues. We will hear various perspectives from the business community and the administration, but not a word from the people these programs are designed to help and whom the pharmacists serve." From the headlines, we move on to the focus of the show, which is the dilemma of mentally ill inmates. First context, the United States has the greatest inmate population of any country on the globe. They have the highest rate of incarceration per capita of any country on the globe. The Universal Declaration of Human Rights notwithstanding, we still have the death penalty, and the homeless continue to be demonized, and their numbers are increasing disproportionately as funding for housing and social services shrink, and universal health care, as we know, remains a mirage. Recent county budget deliberations have had to address shortfalls created by the federal and state cuts to human services. One segment of the population, largely unattended as a result of these cuts, are the mentally ill prison inmates, the focus of tonight's show, many of whom have dealt with homelessness. Upon release, nearly a majority have no housing to return to. What we want to address tonight is the need to intercept these people in the lockup who are dealing with mental illness to help them get on track so that with appropriate support, such as counseling and transitional housing, upon discharge, their lives can assume some hope of stability. To get them help while incarcerated requires adequate nursing staff, yet the proposed budget of the county contains severe cuts to corrections health. Here to discuss what this looks like and what the impact of these cuts will be are Rob Nose, the union rep for the Oregon Nurses Association, and Heather Sanudo, a nurse with the county detention center downtown and on the mental health team. I'd like to welcome you both.
Thanks, Jay. Thanks for having us.
Thank you.
And Rob, I wish you would start things off by describing the cuts.
Well, there's about 10 staff that work in the downtown jail and then at the Inverness Jail and at the Juvenile Detention Center, three jails in the county, that provide mental health services to the inmates that are incarcerated while they're there. The way that the budget cut is playing out is it's about a $1.6 million appropriation that the chair has proposed be cut in half. And so basically it cuts the funding for that program down to $800,000 for the year. And in order to survive that kind of cut, mental health staffing in the jails would have to be pretty much eliminate all of the nurses. You've got 7 to 8 nurses, and then you've got three providers, a nurse practitioner, a physician, some mental health therapists, in order to maintain any kind of semblance of mental health treatment in the jail for the inmates, basically eliminate the nurses.
Would you consider that setup as it stands now adequate? I mean, is that satisfactory in itself?
The nurses that work in those facilities would tell you that they do the best that they can, but most of them would say that the current situation at the current situation as it exists is not, you know, ideal. And so, you know, they're doing the best they can and they're providing appropriate care to the best of the staffing and ability that they have, but it's probably, in their estimation, not good enough.
Right, thanks. Go ahead. Heather, could you respond to the impact that you see that these cuts will have in your experience, what the needs are and what the impact of these cuts would do?
Well, first off, I want to agree with Rob with the fact that we already don't have enough coverage. And we have a psychiatric list of clients that we see every day. And I hear that the list is out 2 to 3 weeks. And that these are for people that are considered not acute. And the impacts of the cuts. Well, without psychiatric nurses, we have the medical nurses would have a lot of extra work. They would have to do the mental health evaluations as well as the medical evaluations. We see people for suicide watch when they come in, and
How are they evaluated when they first come in? How are they evaluated? How do you determine a psychiatric need, for example?
Well, when a person is first booked into jail, they get a medical interview with the medical nurse, and they usually ask them if they have any mental health history, if they've ever tried to hurt themselves before, if they're suicidal now, if they're taking any medications, any sort of medical or mental health problem, and they identify that they have mental health problems, and they usually will put a code in the computer to alert corrections as well that this is a mental health inmate. And then if they say that they're suicidal or they sound like they indicate self-harm, they'll put them on a suicide watch, and then usually it's a 12-hour watch, that, and we come up and evaluate whether or not they're safe to come off of the watch.
What about, I know a lot of people are in for citations, and they're released fairly quickly, and they tend not to give accurate information. They don't want to reveal too much about themselves. And then they wind up being held much longer. How do you follow up on correcting that booking, that first booking evaluation?
Well, if there's citations and they're going to be released, we would call the crisis triage line with the county, and they come in. They'll come in and evaluate them. If they stay, the nurses or the medical nurses in reception are really good about alerting us and calling us, and we come down and see them.
I'd like to mention that we're going to open up the phone lines. If you have questions to ask the two nurses we have here tonight, please call KBOO. The number is 503-231-8187. We have a lot of experience here. This is the mentally ill inmate population is a largely invisible, unspoken-for constituency. They obviously have no political sympathy or clout. The interest that we have is to try to intercept these folks to interrupt the revolving door of being locked up, discharged, locked up again, and then discharged. This is not a human situation for the individual or for the public at large. So it makes sense to intercept these folks and get them on track, which takes money. And instead of providing money for this, and these are admittedly very tight times, the reverse is true. There are severe cuts impending in the proposed budget for the county to corrections health, and that's what we're really concerned about tonight.
Now, Jay, maybe I could give a little picture of like what the cuts, the impacts will be for the cuts. The corrections health estimates that they see about 44,000 inmates a year, and of those 44,000, that's how many are incarcerated, and then 27,000 are seen for some sort of health problem, of which 6,000 to 7,000 present with some sort of mental health problem or issue. And then what they anticipate is that if the cut goes through the way that it's been proposed in the budget, only the most psychotic, the most severe, you know, the inmates that present the most potential for suicide will be seen. And so, you know, as many as 6,000 mentally ill inmates, people that are there right now, you know, will receive no kind of care from somebody like Heather, nobody who evaluates whether they're getting appropriate medication or maybe need some treatment when they get out. And so they run the risk of basically just starting to do all over again what got them in jail in the first place.
Right, precisely. So we have a caller on the line. Caller, can you hear us? Do we have a caller? All right, so I got a little excited here. We have experience in the studio from the nursing staff, but me and Jay are still learning the ropes here. So that was a summary of the proposed cuts that are at hand. What is the rationale for making those cuts now, or what's been discussed as to why something so severe would happen? Just a shortfall?
Well, Part of the rationale for it is that in addition to the federal and state cuts that Jay talked about a little bit earlier, the county is losing ITAX funding. The temporary income tax funding that the Multnomah County voters in for 3 years is sunsetting. It's going away. And so the chair, to try to balance the loss of that funding, has proposed that we would, you know, reduce mental health services down to something that's very bare bones.
I have a question. A person, this is for you, Heather, please. Say a person is incarcerated, a woman whose records haven't been accessed but who appears to have mental health problems. How is she evaluated? How do you determine what her needs are? And how is she followed during her incarceration? And especially with the proposed emergency-only bare-bones corrections nursing staff in place, should this budget proposal become reality, what will happen to that woman? What would be the experience that she would have as things stand currently, as inadequate as they are, and what would the cuts mean as far as her following her all the way through?
Well, a big part of it depends on her behavior. If she comes in, she's booked in and doesn't say that she has mental health problems, and we don't know, oftentimes they're picked up later on in their jail stay. The deputies will notice, or the nurses will notice, or if she decides, I'm staying long enough now, I'll let someone know, she'll put in a request to be seen. If it's not an acute, you know, severe, persistent mental illness, it's not going to be, she won't be seen as quickly with the staff that we have now. And if this goes through and it becomes worse, then, you know, a mental illness that's not as severe is not going to be treated or not be given a lot of attention. Right now we can treat depression and anxiety and things that we won't be able to treat later on. We'll be treating the suicidal or the acutely psychotic people.
So in other words, the impact of these cuts would take people who perhaps you could be the biggest immediate assistance of, right. You know, people who don't necessarily have something that's so full-blown that everything in their life is out of whack, but the kind of thing, if they got some attention for
right.
the depression.
People that we could stabilize.
People that we could stabilize. And that is essentially what is on the cutting block.
So far, yeah.
Can you tell us, give us some instances or an instance that you've seen a woman, for example, since you were there, since the staffing was there, namely yourself, that you sort of perceived that this person was having problems that, say, a deputy is not going to recognize, and you realize that this person needed some help, and you sort of inserted yourself to see what the situation was and get a better evaluation and how that played out?
Well, a few weeks ago I was called down to reception to the booking area to see someone. Well, as an aside, we have a lot of people that come into booking that are on meth, and the meth epidemic has made this so much worse. The mental health, our mental health assessments, you don't know if they're on meth or if they have mental health problems or they have mental health problems because of the meth. But I came down to see someone that the deputies do identify as, oh, he's acting weird, or his behavior is odd, or they put him in a separation cell because he's not complying or not following the rules. And he was mentally retarded, developmentally delayed. And he was so delayed, he couldn't respond to the questions appropriately, and you had a hard time understanding him.
What was the charge?
I think he was a county hold, so we didn't know what the original charge was. The police picked him up, and he had a hold, and I think he had been in jail years and years before, just for a citation, was released, didn't go to court, and so he was completely out of his element, was really afraid, and they had put him in a separation cell. And so we had him moved up to our psychiatric unit, which is a 10-bed unit. We had him moved upstairs, and we monitored him. And it was kind of difficult to find out any information, what medications he was taking, if he lived in a foster care home or if he lived on his own. And so just kept talking to him, going, the unit is really close to our medical unit. And kept going in and talking to him, and finally got a few names and names of places that I could call. And I called the apartment complex that he lived at, got information from the lady, and we got his meds restarted the next day. And I actually followed him to court, which we don't ever do, but just to see what would happen. And they ended up keeping him. He wasn't able to answer any of the questions, but we got him started on his meds, and then we contacted the counselor who worked with someone in the community, and they got him out earlier.
I'd like to remind you of the phone number. Please call. It's 503-231-8187. And I think we have a caller now. Caller?
Hello.
How are you doing?
I'm great, thanks.
What is your question?
Well, it's not really a question, more than just a comment. You know, it seems like not getting treatment to people in the jails is a real lost opportunity. It's not like they go away, you know. They end up then costing emergency personnel, you know, it goes to the community, of course, for costs. They end up costing in our emergency rooms and our hospitals, you know, the rotating door. And all the community is going to be paying for that. It's just this one time when they're in the jail and there's nurses and personnel available, if we don't get treatment to these people, it's going to cost us a lot more in the long run, seems to me.
That's right. An excellent point.
Very good point.
I couldn't have said it better myself. I mean, part of what Corrections Health is doing is making it so that when people get released out into the community, they're less likely to need care in more expensive settings, or they don't pass on communicable diseases that they receive when they're out there, because, you know, people do get out of jail, they get released, and, you know, whatever they're carrying with them is exposed to the rest of us. And
yeah.
It's really good public health policy to take care of people like that.
Yeah, I mean, you know, it seems like panhandlers, you see a lot of people walking down the street talking to themselves who don't have cell phones in their hands. So it affects all of us every day, and it's going to cost us all a whole lot more money in the long run, it seems to me, if we don't provide care for these people. And already the amount of care that's available is really minimal, really minimal.
Well, and I think I'd even take it one step further and say, you know, we're in this time as a society where we're looking at people with a disability, with a condition that is often beyond any control of their own. I mean, these are not necessarily like the people who are using, although drug addiction is also a disability. But when you talk about people with strict mental illness, to say that our societal solution is to put people in jail is harsh enough. But to give them the double whammy of we're going to put you in jail and do nothing to help the reason that got you there is cruel and inhumane.
Well, it is. It's unethical. It's immoral. And, you know, not treating these people, their problems just don't go away. And they don't just go away.
You know, a lot of the nurses have talked about the fact that, you know, the meth epidemic that Heather brought up a little bit earlier, but also that, you know, mental health services in our county have been underfunded, in some ways eliminated or reduced in response to a lot of the budget cutting that's gone on at the federal, state level, the loss of the income tax again. And so many of the nurses will tell you, this is anecdotal, that they have sort of become the place to receive mental health care. If you are mentally ill in our community, the place that you're only going to really get any kind of treatment, you know, is mm-hmm. probably in jail.
Well, living on the streets is a really harsh way to live. And if you have mental illness and you can't get medications to help you deal with your illnesses and your internal agonies, you're going to find your own medications, you know, street medications. And then you have a bigger problem. So it just seems to exacerbate itself because we don't provide adequately for these people. That's what I have to say.
Right. Caller, thank you very much. We've mm-hmm. we've got another caller, as a matter of fact. Caller, are you there?
Hi, yeah.
How are you doing?
I'm great. How are you?
Pretty good.
I'm calling. I agree with the previous caller, and it also seems to me that it's a public safety issue if people are acting out in the community and out of control because of untreated mental health issues, because they don't have insurance or what have you, and they end up in the jail system. It seems like a great time to capture that and help them get treatment and help them get into a transitional housing situation when they get out. And I'm wondering if there's anything the public can do to impact this budget decision yet. Is this written in stone, or is there anything that people can do to influence the county chair and the commissioners?
Well, unfortunately, tonight is a budget hearing for the county, but there will be one last budget hearing on June 12th, and I'm not sure exactly where that is.
I think it's actually going to be at the Hawthorne Building, the main county Hawthorne Building, the hearing.
501 Southeast Hawthorne, right across the bridge.
Yeah, it seems like an important issue that I think people should pay attention to.
Very definitely. And contact your commissioners and let them know what your concerns are.
Great, thanks.
Thank you. We'll now take we have a music break, and we'll be back shortly.
Something, must be something we can do.
Welcome back. This is Hole in the Bucket, the KBOO show on the homeless. My name is Jay Thiemeyer. My co-facilitator is Mike Anderson. And that was Must Be Something by Gil Scott-Heron. Our two guests are Rob Nose with the Oregon Nurses Association and Heather Sanudo, who is on the mental health unit at the detention center, a nurse. And we've been talking about the plight of mentally ill inmates and what we can do about it. The next part of this, I sent an email to one of the commissioners, Serena Cruz Walsh, expressing my concern about the lack of attention in the budget to taking care of mentally ill inmates, to intercept them, to break the revolving door of being locked up, discharged, locked up again, and so on. And she sent an email back in which she said a couple of things that will be discussed by Rob and Heather. Quote, we need to serve, Commissioner Cruz Walsh said, we need to serve the mentally ill in our jails. While the chair proposed cutting this particular service to Corrections Health, I intend to purchase those services. Let me see. Further down, you may not agree with me, but when we go for accreditation in our jails, we are spending money to prove to a professional organization that we have a very high standard of care. I don't want to have top-flight care in our jails and continue to turn people away in the community who can't get into our clinics, our mental health facilities, etc. I want to provide inmates with the most basic care that we can that will protect them and our employees. This means that the homeless and the mentally ill will receive basic mental health care in our jails, but hopefully they'll receive much better health care, housing, et cetera, outside. With respect to her concern, I would like to discuss those remarks about accreditation.
Okay, accreditation, I think, has unfortunately taken on this like myth of like somehow it's like a, to use a car analogy, it's some sort of Cadillac healthcare service that inmates in our jail system are receiving. It's quite the contrary. It serves two purposes. The first and most important is it provides for a basic minimal level of care. And Heather can talk a little bit in more detail when I get done here about what that kind of minimum things are that accreditation provides. It is not like some standard of care that is much better than those of us who aren't in jail receiving the community if we're fortunate enough to have health care. I think the other thing that the county commissioner is a little remiss in understanding is that because the jail is accredited, community people, and you know, not everybody in jail has a heart of gold, right? Sometimes people get in there and they try to figure out how to work the system and abuse it and sue the county, all right? Claiming that they didn't receive appropriate treatment for whatever their health concern was when they were incarcerated and in that situation. That basic level of care that is assured for with the accreditation standard assures that lawyers out there who want to work for huckster clients don't have a very good case. If you're accredited as a jail, you're providing a basic level of care that is good enough to catch things, detect illness, detect problems, and make sure they get treated. It's not like going to a spa or going to the kind of benefit that people enjoy.
Right, and by definition, the revolving door means that they are being treated repeatedly over and over again without any real resolution. So it's costing a lot more over a period of time.
And I imagine they have better care in the community. We need to be able to stabilize them in the jail so they will want to go in the community so that they'll follow up and be treated. And if we're not treating them, then they're not going to take their medicine. They're not going to go for follow-up.
Well, and it seems almost that Commissioner Cruz Walsh sort of flipped around the problem that the last caller was talking about, which is, unfortunately, our correction system is the last bastion of mental health services. And to say, well, we're going to cut it because we don't want people who are outside, feeling left out. I mean, that's, You know, you need to, that doesn't address the fundamental problem, which is people wind up in jail because there was nothing outside to help them stabilize. I mean, again, there's people who don't have the heart of gold, but there's also a lot of people who are getting caught up in some very bad situations because they don't have the mental wherewithal to make the good decisions they would if they were getting the consistent treatment.
Right. I think the problem is that people are not – there isn't adequate funding for mental health treatment on the outside. People are not being sufficiently monitored. They're not in a stable situation. They lose their housing. If they're on appropriate medications, that's not being sufficiently monitored. They stop taking their meds. They lose their housing. They wind up on the street where they're either bum-bashed or incarcerated, or if you run into a cop who can't distinguish between someone in acute need – and a threat that needs to be eliminated, they're in a lot of trouble. So if they're in, what you have is, by default, the prisons become institutions for mental health treatment, and that's a real tragedy.
And I've heard time and again that we're the second largest mental health facility, treatment facility in Oregon.
Well, yeah, I've heard that.
And I think it's interesting that the commissioner thinks accreditation is a bad thing to have. It's not a, you know, initials after the end of the jail that says this meets some sort of gold standard. It's nursing procedures that are done by nurses when inmates come into the system, you know, to make sure they get treated appropriately for whatever their issue is.
Right, and also cuts out lawsuits. And we have a 10-bed, as I said before, psychiatric unit and a 10-bed medical unit. And accreditation standards, we need to see each of the clients in those units every day and chart on them and you know, continually evaluate them daily. You know, the accreditation standards say we need to respond to medical requests within a certain amount of time. I want to say 48 hours.
24.
24 hours. The standards they keep us in check, and the fact that we meet the standards just shows what great care we have in the jail.
Well, and another part of the standard is that everybody that comes in gets evaluated by a medical professional, by a nurse. And if funding for the accreditation procedures and the nurses that provide it goes away, what's going to happen is that the evaluation is done by the deputies. Now, you know, no offense to those men that are taking care of people in the jail doing that, but they're not medically trained professionals. And there's a lot of evidence to say that people who are incarcerated are not going to be very willing to kind of be forthcoming with their medical concerns with people that are managing them while they're actually in jail.
So we are talking tonight about the revolving door of mental illness, the correction system, and living on the street. And we're talking about mainly a proposed cut at the Multnomah County level that would take away from the few services that there are that help combat this issue. So if you're listening and you want to chime into this conversation, our number is 503-231-8187.
Yes, thank you. Can't remember what I was going to say. I was interested in a couple of things. The difficulty in accessing records from outside for a person, are there problems with confidentiality? How does that work out?
Right. That's always the difficulty. And when they come in to booking is when, of course, we try to catch anyone that's on medication or being treated. And then we have to have them sign a release of information, fax it to the other facility, and hope that we'll get information, call. And it's kind of a time-consuming thing sometimes. Mental health facilities, of course, it's even harder. What can be really difficult is if the person is acutely psychotic and doesn't quite know where they are, or, you know, you can't get any information out of them. So that's always a difficult thing. And we have the fortunate thing is we do have a lot of repeat inmates, people that come in, cycle over and over. And so we do have histories on a lot of the psychiatric people that come in, and oftentimes we can have the doctor restart the medications they were on before and wait for the information. But, you know, that's...
Do you have statistics on repeats and what sort of illnesses the repeats are dealing with? For example, acute folks.
Right. I have some statistics, but it's from March, the final draft, March 2005. It was a study of people with mental illness in the criminal justice system in Montgomery
County. Go ahead.
I
think it's interesting stuff. Yeah, go ahead and share it.
Well, in 2005, there were 24,759 people booked into the county jail, some more than once, for a total of 41,139 bookings. Of those, 3,413 were people that were had a medical alert, a psychiatric alert. Sorry, they found that of these 3,000 people, 13% of them represented the total booked population. So 13% of the people that were booked are mentally ill.
So and that's gone up a little bit for since that was published.
They were able to divide these numbers of people into a high bookings group and a group that was booked left less often. Of the 43% of which was the high bookings group, the people that came in over and over, a diagnosis of severe and persistent mental illness was on the record for 43% of them. And so the ones that it just shows that the ones that are booked most often are the ones with the severe and persistent mental illness. I think that's...
It's pretty telling.
Obviously, the expense of those repeats is considerable and basically unknown, pretty much.
Well, and it noted also that the length of stay for the persistent, severe mentally ill tended to be much longer than the people that aren't, you know, the less frequent booked people.
Do you have any percentage of or any statistics on how many of those, seriously psychotic people had housing, monitored housing to return to?
No, I don't have those statistics, right. But that would be a great study.
I've read some incredible information about the high percentage of people who have no housing upon discharge.
Mm-hmm.
Mentally ill as well as others.
Right, and we have one discharge planner in the jail. She works at Inverness, and I think she comes downtown once a week. And I'm sure she would be one of the ones.
Cut.
She's part of the mental health team. And
she'd be one of the ones cut.
Wow. So once again, the number here for callers, 503-231-8187. Join the conversation. Heather, we've spent a lot of time talking about mental illness, and you know, a lot of ways that overlaps with drug and alcohol addiction. But can you talk a little bit in terms of what you're called upon for that role right now in the corrections, and again, what it might look like if, in the event these bad cuts went through?
Well, as a psychiatric nurse, we do get called quite a bit for someone that's going through DTs. They can be DTing from alcohol or Klonopin, and they may appear psychotic. They don't know where they are. They don't know what's going on, and they're just actually going through withdrawal. We treat alcohol withdrawal and Klonopin withdrawal, heroin withdrawal. As the psychiatric nurse, I would go up and evaluate them. The medical nurses would treat them for alcohol or for withdrawal.
Do you know if I know at one time at Inverness they had a dorm that was assigned to treatment inmates who were going to be transferred out or discharged out into a treatment facility. Is that still in existence? Because I know its funding was really in jeopardy.
I don't think we have a treatment. We don't have a treatment dorm. We have a dorm 13 out at Inverness, which is for the mentally ill that aren't so acute that they would have to stay downtown. Mm-hmm. Once we get them stabilized on medication, we send them out there, and it's more therapeutic. I mean, jail isn't therapeutic, but if there were a therapeutic place in jail, it's dorm 13. And they do have the discharge planner comes in and meets with them, and we have specially trained deputies that are very good.
How are they specially trained?
I think that they go through a training once, I want to say once a year, and the mental health team, it's a multidisciplinary team that comes and does the training, and they have multidisciplinary meetings weekly, I think, out there, or maybe twice a week, and it involves corrections and mental health staff and medical staff, and it's really good about they do discharge planning and they talk about the inmates on that dorm, and I mean it's a wonderful setup.
How many people are taken care of on that dorm? I mean, is it adequate?
There's always a list of people that want to go out to dorm 13 or people that we want to send out there. But at this point, we have so many people that are also unstable and they can't go out to Inverness. And we don't have anything like a dorm 13 downtown.
Right. So basically downtown at the detention center, they're backed up. They're effectively warehoused until they can get more appropriate.
Right. And they can't have any, they can't, they have to be stable before they can go to Inverness. And so that's why most of our acutely mentally ill stay downtown.
You know, Jay, I just thought of something. We, as part of the cut that's happening with mental health, if it goes through and with accreditation, we'll lose additional nursing staff out at the juvenile justice facility. A few years back, as a response to budget cuts that were implemented, they used to have 24-hour nursing care for juvenile, and they eliminated the night shift nurse. And now they're contemplating eliminating the evening shift nurse, and basically youth that are incarcerated will only have access to a medical professional on the day shift. And while that might not seem so bad, it really kind of reduces the ability of our system to respond to things that are happening. It means people have to wait. It means things back up. And stuff might get missed. I mean, there was a lot of concern when the night shift nurse was eliminated, and now we would be scaling back that even further.
And what a giant cost to the county every time the counselors or the staff there would have to send someone out to the hospital because they didn't have someone to evaluate them.
You should talk a little bit more about that. People probably don't understand that. So
let's hear about that. I'm going to give the number one more time in the event that we have a caller who's just dying to get involved, but they don't know where to call. It's 231-8187. And, yeah, do you want to elaborate?
The nursing staff were there 24 hours a day, and whenever a problem arises, someone's passed out on the floor or something happens, someone's having a seizure, the deputies call a medical backup, and we respond as a team. And, you know, we evaluate them and decide what needs to happen, and more – more often than not, we don't have to send them out. But send them out to the hospital rather than have them see our provider or our doctor.
It's almost like you're a 24-hour hospital facility in some ways.
Right. And especially in the intake, when people come in and you have no idea what's on board. You don't know if they have mental illness or if they've taken some drugs or what kind of medical problems they have. And they're angry and they're put in a separation cell and you can't get any information, and we need our nursing staff for that. And
it's like an ER in some ways.
Mm-hmm. And when we do ultimately have to send them to the ER, if there were not nursing staff available and the deputies just had to send them out, it would be a giant cost every time they go out.
Right. I don't imagine, from what we know of the deputies at intake, that they would be, you know, really attuned to ask, do you have a heart condition? Do you have diabetes? Do you have this whole litany of things that need to be addressed on intake? If a person is, you know, susceptible to some sort of crisis, only a nurse could really know how to ask the questions and what to deal with.
Right, they go to school for that very reason.
Exactly.
Right. And they're not attuned to health needs. They're there for discipline and to be deputies.
Right, exactly.
Well, one of the things that we always like to do here at KBOO is we love to give people good information. We also like to give people an opportunity to take action once they've gotten some information. And I think this has been a very compelling discussion tonight about, you know, whether you look at it from the human perspective, whether you look at it from the budget perspective, whether you look at it from the public safety perspective, that the county's on the verge of a pretty careless, bad decision. So what would you tell our listeners out there, if they wanted to get in touch with their county commissioner, what should they say in order to help the commissioners understand why this cut can't be made?
Well, I would, first of all, tell them that, you know, it's not a waste of your time to email or call the commissioner's office. They really do listen to what constituents have to say. And if you have a compelling story to tell, you know, make an appointment and go down and tell it to them. Secondly, even in these difficult fiscal times, there is, since the chair has put her budget out, Diane Lynn, you know, writes the first draft, so to speak, and then the rest of the commissioners get a chance to make amendments and changes, additional, you know, revenue that wasn't anticipated when the chair put her budget together has shown up. And this is a common occurrence that happens in all government budgeting. You make a forecast for what taxes and revenue collection is going to look like, and then, you know, additional money shows up later because the forecast was just that, a prediction. And so there is money available to backfill and pay for mental health, nursing, the way that it exists currently, to pay for accreditation, and just tell the commissioners, you know, this is a priority and they should find the money to pay for it. And they, you know, you don't have to be an expert as a citizen to say, find it from this or find it from that. Those county commissioners, they know where the money's available, and it's a question of political will to pay for it.
Do you really think that at the work session of the county around the budget that took place yesterday morning, the impression I had very clearly was that some commissioners had their minds very much made up?
Well, you know, time and time again, I've thought that as well, and I can tell you from sitting in for other less controversial topics that people show up and make their case, and the county commissioners change their mind. And I don't think that's a criticism of them. I actually think, unlike, you know, the chief commanding officer of the country who feels it's a sign of weakness to not change your mind, I think it's a sign of leadership to say, I didn't have information that I have now, and we're going to make a different decision based on that. So, you know, I encourage people, the county commissioners, they have a tough job. It's not an easy thing to try to figure out how to balance all of these competing priorities. But they do listen to people, and, you know, in some level, the squeaky wheel gets the grease.
Okay. And I want to say in 2005, another statistic, 13.8% of people booked into the jail had mental illness. They have brothers and sisters and families in Portland that can call, that can write letters and talk about the care that they received in the jail, and not just the mentally ill, but the people that have received medical care.
You know, and I think, you know, as we've all identified, as their caller identified, there's so many reasons to get involved in this issue, you know, from the short-sightedness, from the public safety issue, the humanitarian issue. Now, there's a hearing coming up on the 12th of June. It's the last budget hearing. Can one more time we get a little bit of information? Because maybe some of our listeners could attend that.
Right, and that's at the county building, which is 501 Southeast Hawthorne. And what time is that?
It'll start at 6 p.m. For those of you that want to get there and testify, I would say show up a little bit early. They'll start signing people up before the actual hearing. And, you know, they'll limit your testimony. There'll be a lot of people that will want to talk. And so keep your comments brief. But they'll stay and listen and hear what everybody has to say. And then ultimately there'll be another budget work session. And then the county budget has to get ratified on June 22nd. That's the final day in the process.
I would sort of conclude with I think we all agree that we share the same concerns for a viable community, and that it's surprising when a commissioner does not consider mentally ill inmates as deserving of inclusion in that committee. And that's what we hope we've addressed somewhat tonight. I'd like to thank our guests, Rob Nose with the Oregon Nurses Association, and Heather Sanudo, who is with the mental health team at the detention center, working directly with inmates, trying to evaluate and get them on track with the limited funding that they have. So if you're concerned about the cuts impending to corrections health, please call your commissioners and don't let this pass by the way.
And also remember, this Hole in the Bucket show, we got the good fortune to do the fifth Wednesday of the month, but our normal show is the second Wednesday of the month, which means we'll be coming at you again on June 14th. We have a great show. We're going to be talking about homelessness, particularly one of the largest growing populations of the homeless, which is families with children. We are going to hear from several people from around the state talking about the challenges that children in particular face when they don't have a stable place to call home. Jay, you have a brief announcement, and then I have one last one. We'll say goodnight.
Right. Just very briefly, this coming Saturday, At 3 o'clock, there's the Recovery Association Project is opening their new site, which is at 1100 Northeast 28th, not that far north of Cebu, on the east side of the river. Let me see. That's going to be 3 until midnight. Live band from 9 to midnight. There will be a 12-step meeting from 7 to 8:30. It's going to be it ought to be a big celebration. Anyone who's interested in friends and family members who are recovering.
And also a celebration of different sorts, a celebration of words. My co-host, Jay Thiemeyer, will be reading from his work, Marginal Notes, on the second Monday of June at Borders Books downtown at 30 Yamhill at 7 p.m. You probably heard Jay on a lot of different shows on here. If he's ever read his writing and you've heard it, you know how good it is. So we have that to look forward to. Thank you, Jay, for doing that. And for our KBOO listeners, we wish you a good evening. Thank you so much. This is KBOO 90.7. You've been listening to Hole in the Bucket Show. We're going to have a little community calendar, and then we welcome on DJ Audio. Thank you, and good night.
He's America's most censored journalist. He uncovered how George Bush stole the election in 2000 and again in 2004. Now he's ready to show you the whole armed madhouse, from stolen ballot boxes to the war on terror as profit center. KBOO 90.7 FM and the Portland Alliance brings you Greg Palast on Monday, June 5th, at First Unitarian Universalist Church at 1011 Southwest 12th Avenue. Admission $8 to $15. Program begins at 7 p.m., doors open at 6:30. Hosted by Dave Mazza and includes special guest Air America's Tom Hartman. Don't miss Greg's reading from his new book, Armed Madhouse, Dispatches from the Front.